Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics, what the fuck Minster Fullers? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show. This is WTF. I just woke up. I'm in a hotel room in Dallas, Texas, and just did a show. Oh, wait, I'm in Houston. Sorry. I apologize, Texas. Does it matter? I'm in one of those older, you know, maybe Hyatts from the 70s where all the balconies are lined up. So you can see they surround the lobby, but they go up like 20 floors and you can look out and it's just a stack of balconies. When you go out to outside your door, you have a hallucinogenic experience by the strange angles and the horrible heights. And it's not pleasant to wake up to. I don't really have a fear of heights, but you don't have to punch me in the face with it. The glass elevators going up and down, all the angles. I'm woozy. I had to go get coffee, and I felt like I was going through some sort of dreamscape. How is everybody? I'm okay. Today, Zach Woods is on the show, who is a lovely man and an amazing comedic talent and a guy that I'm a big fan of. It's a very odd thing with Zach. And maybe I should – it's not odd, but the guy made an impact on me somehow as an amazingly funny and talented person, brilliant person. Just organically, didn't even have to seek it out. Well, what happened was, you know, I'd seen a little bit of Zach's work on The Office, but I don't watch The Office. Never really watched it that much. And then I watched first season of Silicon Valley, and I saw him in that. Jared is the character Zach Woods plays on Silicon Valley. Also on that show, as you know, is my assistant on my show, Josh Brenner, who plays Big Head. I think he's back for a few episodes there, but he's also back for a few episodes of Maron on IFC, which premieres May 14th on IFC. If you could get IFC for even a few months, that would be nice because that would change the number profile of the ratings system so that it would make more people watch it in relatively real time on the network it's presented on. If you could do that for me, that would be nice because there's still an old style paradigm in place for how people judged the success of television shows with those numbers. So, that's my pitch. How are you? Anyway, Zach Woods. So I'd seen his work on Silicon Valley, and I dug it. I thought he was funny. But then my niece Eden came into town. I don't remember when that was. And the only place I can think to take her, to take the kids, is the UCB because they don't have an age thing. You can go in with kids. So we went to see ASCAT at UCB, and this guy, Zach Woods, was performing in the ASCAT crew as one of the improvisers. And I was like, holy shit, that guy's like some kind of fucking wizard. And then months later, when my other niece, Matana, came out, I took her to UCB. I also took her to Largo. And Zach was there again just by coincidence. And I'm like, he fucking did it again. Guy's impressive. And then I sought him out. And then we made this happen. And we had this conversation with him. He's lovely guy, talented guy, good conversation. All right? He was on The Office. He's on Veep. In the Loop was a film that sort of broke him, and he's currently, you can see him on Silicon Valley. Did a show. Here's what's been going on with me. And then I got big tour announcements. So hang in. Hang in for a minute and listen to me. That's what we call a tease, big tour announcements. Coming up. Coming up is the key word to the tease. After this, stay tuned. Right after these things, all of those are tricks. They're tricks to keep you there. So you listen through the advertisements. You listen through the advertisements. Oh my God, after these, I'm going to say something amazing. Holy shit, if you leave, you're going to miss something you're going to regret. So please, stay here. Things you don't have to do on a podcast for 100, Alex. I'm in Texas, and every time I'm in Texas, I have this weird feeling that there has always been something in my head that has been threatened by Texas, that Texas was this huge monster of a state right next to the state I grew up in. We judge Texans, as you witnessed from my conversation with Mike Judge. But every time I come here, every time I drive here, because I rented a car again to drive Ashley and I, my opening act, Ashley Barnhill, doing a great job. We're in Austin where I rented a car primarily to get barbecue. Like my willingness and desire to get barbecue, willingness, what a funny word. Yes, I'm willing to eat barbecue. No, I fucking need it once a year, it seems. But I rented the car primarily to get barbecue. And then I'm like, well, let's just, you know, drive the rest of these gigs. So we drove from Austin to Houston. And today we're driving from Houston to Dallas. But every time I drive through the great state of Texas, I am amazed at its integrity as its own fucking country. The people in Texas, you're just sort of like, look at, they look like Texans. They're big, strong jawed people, lanky, cowboy style people that look like they can handle cattle and wrestle things. But I'm always I find them charming, more charming as each visit. And I know that sounds odd, but as I get older and softer in my heart and mind, I have a more open approach to the peoples of the world. And I think I always had it. I think I just had to reopen that door. But so Austin, Texas, the Moon Tower Comedy Festival went great. Thank you if you came out. We had almost a full house at the Paramount Theater in Austin. It was a great show, a good time. Did a nice long one for the peoples. And then the next day I went to barbecue. Me and Nate Bargatze, the great Nate Bargatze. He's got a special coming out in a few weeks. We should talk to him. He's one of my favorites. Me and Nate Bargatze, Todd Barry, who I go way back with, and Kurt Metzger, another guy I got to get on the show, hilarious guy, writes for Amy Schumer's show. We made the comedian pilgrimage out to Opie's in Spicewood, Texas, where I go. That's where I go. Anyone else can go wherever they want. Stay in town, go to Lockhart, go to Mueller's up in Taylor, wherever you want to go. But I go get meat at Opie's. And I brought my friends with me. And it's weird because in Texas, a half-hour drive feels like an hour and a half. So these guys were chomping at the bit. They were like, where are we going? Then we come into Opie's. And they've upped their game at that place. So we all got a pile of meat. I swear to God, Austin is like, it's like Disneyland, but all the rides are meat. But so, you know, we got our meat and we shoved all that meat in our face. Every time we have barbecue, there's a mixed feeling. There's the feeling of like, this is amazing. And right after that, it's like, I can't ever do this again, ever in my life. I can't do it anymore. I have high cholesterol. I'm a 51-year-old man. I'm not old by any means, but at some point I have to behave and eat like a fucking person that's trying to take care of themselves. But the road, man, the road gets me. I'm out on the road. I can't eat well. I can't, you know, like this rationalization of the road. And granted, you know, I'm not out here, you know, with one syringe in my arm of coke and one syringe in my arm of heroin, like Freddie King style. I'm not out here, drinking. I'm not out here drinking all night. What I'm doing is I'm not exercising and I'm justifying and rationalizing my desire to eat horrible food. I had chicken and waffles two nights ago. The night after a barbecue, I had chicken and waffles. Why don't I just put a gun in my mouth? Because why do I got to do that? Why, folks, why do we do it? Like, I'm okay. Why can't I enjoy some bad food? Why can't I just live with the fact that I went out and had ice cream last night? Why does this have to be the ongoing dialogue in my heart and mind? My heart that's slowly getting clogged and my mind that no longer understands that I'm an old man. Why can't I get my heart and mind on the same page and just allow me to eat these things and decide that it's worth dying for? It's worth it. How did he live? Well, he had barbecue once a year that he, you know, resented himself for, but I don't think that's what killed him. I don't think it was the chicken and waffles that he had twice in his life or the ice cream that, you know, he overdid sometimes, but in retrospect, in the big picture, didn't eat too much of. I don't think it was the genetic predisposition to high cholesterol. I don't think that's what killed him. What really killed him was the amount he beat himself up for engaging in things he enjoyed. It's a sad state of affairs. The guilt and the shame and the amount that he just made himself feel horrible for eating things that were fun is what killed this man. That's what did it. his heart got tired of him beating the shit out of himself. It's a very sad story. But I'll tell you this. I'll tell you this. It was fun to see my friends. That's the one thing about festivals. It was great to go out and eat with those guys and talk to those guys and laugh with those guys. And I had chicken waffles with Blaine Kapach and the amazing Dana Gould. And these are people I've known for 20 years. And we don't see each other much. And we get to hang out and eat bad food and laugh. That is the one element, and I know I've talked about this before, but the greatest thing about being a comedian is hanging out with a bunch of other brilliant motherfuckers who know how to make you laugh and have to do it instinctively. They have to do it more than communicate like regular people, and you just fucking laugh. It's just fucking amazing. And I'm getting nostalgic. I'm tearing up. And also, I have to say that I went and watched Maria Bamford night before last, and I hadn't seen her in a while. And still, I will stand by my belief that she is the best fucking comedian working. She's possessed by true genius. And I'm a jaded person, and I sat in that theater and I had to pee, and I didn't go pee because I didn't want to miss her. Loved seeing her. She got married. I think she's happier. But what she does on stage is unlike anything else, and it is inspired. She's channeling some sort of mysterious comedy wizard muse. Fucking, you watch Maria Bamford, you walk out, you're like, why do I even do this? She did it all. Something she did it. There's nothing. No one's gonna be as good as her. So I got to head to Dallas now, and I'm gonna send you back to the garage and listen to my conversation with Zach Wood.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Good. I've seen you a couple times. That's why, it's funny. Like, I when I first watched the show Silicon Valley,
right.
I was like, oh, I know that guy. And I brought, for some reason, one of the things that I can do with my underage nieces,
yeah,
is take them to UCB. And I would take them to ASCAT if they came to visit me. So I brought them to, I brought the older one, the first one, to a show, and you were on it. And I was like, oh, that's that guy from, and I put it together, and because you're very funny. You're a good improviser.
Thank you. That's nice.
You're very funny on the show.
Thank you.
But then I went with my other niece, months later, and you were there again.
Dog shit.
No, you were funny, okay. But I was like, there he is again, that guy.
Yeah.
And you're very funny both times, and you seem to be different than the most of them, the improvisers. I don't know how. You're an oddball of some kind.
Yeah.
So do you love doing it? Is that why you go back and do it?
Yeah, I love it so much. That was the first thing. I started doing improv before I had any aspirations towards anything else. I wanted to be a musician when I was a kid. I played trumpet. And I
really?
Yeah.
Wait, where'd you grow up?
I was born in Trenton, New Jersey, and I grew up in Yardley, which is in Bucks County. It's like a suburb of Philadelphia.
Philly?
Yeah.
I like Philadelphia.
Yeah, I never got into it, weirdly. I don't know what it was. I always found it a little depressing, but...
Well, it is depressing.
It's depressing, right?
I think Pennsylvania in general is a little dark. I was just talking about that on the show recently, because I've been there. I went to Pittsburgh. Yeah. I was in Philly. It's heavy, man.
It feels like, as a state, it's on the downslope of its existence. Like, its best days are behind it.
Maybe. Well, they're trying to sort of... Philly, that the renovation and stuff downtown, it's sort of worked.
They're trying.
It feels vital, but it just feels like there's a dark and post-industrial vibe.
It's also, Philadelphia is kind of a racist city, and sports, I'm not a big sports guy, but I remember when I was growing up, Santa Claus would skate onto the ice around Christmas time at Flyers games, and people would throw batteries at Santa Claus.
They
That's not racist. That's just weird anti-Santa shit.
Yeah, like, no.
That's just fucked up.
Yeah, like, it's so weird. Because also batteries, like, you could throw drinks or things that they have at the stadium, but batteries are premeditated. Like, you have to bring a battery home.
I don't make sense of it.
I don't know.
Why batteries by specifically at Santa?
It's a complicated combination of elements. I think maybe... Maybe it's just like, well, there's an embodiment of pure childhood joy and that...
Yeah, kill it.
Yeah, destroy it. Destroy it like it was destroyed in us.
There's no room for that anymore.
Yeah.
That's... maybe that is it.
There's parts of Philly that are really nice, you know, but...
But Trenton, how'd you end up... So you're sort of genetically New Jersey?
Yeah, my parents are both in Bergen County. Like,
mine too.
Yeah, really?
Not Bergen County. But Morris County.
Okay, yeah, close.
Wow.
I feel like New Jersey, I have a lot of nostalgia for Jersey. Like the Turnpike, I really love the Turnpike. Like,
sure.
All those old, you know, it's hideous.
The turnstiles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like
where
it.
Throw your quarter. Remember when your grandpa used to let you throw the quarter in the basket?
No, that never happened.
That never happened.
Am
I projecting it?
You know, you mean at the tolls.
Toll. Yeah. Yeah, you know, he's like, can I throw it in? And then you'd hear a click in, and then the thing would come up?
No, my grandfather was, disengaged, I guess.
You weren't afforded that.
I feel so deprived.
Of that New Jersey. So how long were you in Jersey?
I was there till I was like 3 or 4. Trenton is really not a great safe city anymore, because when Martin Luther King got killed, this could be totally wrong, but this is what I remember, that there were big riots and the city kind of never recovered. So it's got all this like... Victorian architecture, but then it's very, very dangerous. So it's like the set of Meet Me in St. Louis, but like then the action of The Wire or whatever. You know, it's like, yeah.
Yeah. But you, when you're on the train, you drive past that big sign, right? Well, Trenton is industry.
Trenton makes, yeah, the, this Trenton is the bridge makes, says, it says, Trenton makes the world takes. It's the most indignant bridge. I think initially it meant like Trenton makes stuff and then the world takes it. But industry. Now it feels like, take and take.
I think it's all gone at this point.
Yeah.
What did they make there? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know what they used to make.
All right. So what's your family doing in outside of Philly?
They used to live in, my parents met in Vermont, and then they moved
Vermont.
To Vermont.
They were in college there?
They met at a mental hospital. My mother and father worked at a mental hospital.
Really?
Yeah, my mom was my father's supervisor.
That's better than his nurse.
Yeah, right.
Your mom was your dad's supervisor at a mental hospital. So
yeah.
Your mom was a hospital administrator, or is she a doctor?
No, she's a nurse practitioner, but she was he was like a low man on the totem pole. Maybe they were just working in the psychiatric wing of it. They met in Bedlam.
Yeah.
And then they ended up moving to New York. My father's a shrink, and so he was getting his degree in...
Oh, so he was a student or something when
he had
they
to
met?
Go to New York, then they moved to Trenton, and then when they...
But kids, when they met...
Yeah.
He was a student, kind of, or an intern?
He finished his undergraduate education, but he was like, yeah, he was doing some...
Uh-huh.
I guess he was an intern. I should know more about this.
No, you shouldn't. So he's a psychiatrist?
He's a social worker, but he does clinical therapy.
So he's a social worker, yeah. So he's noble.
Yeah.
He's well, in righteous. Theory.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
He's a do-gooder.
Yeah, he didn't settle for private practice.
Well, he actually did. He does run a private practice. Yeah. So, yeah, social
but he's, that's but that's his degree, CSW.
Yeah, right.
Oh. So you grew up with a shrink as a dad.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have an older brother and a younger sister.
Oh, and you had an older brother too to mm-hmm. guide you through things.
Yeah, I guess so.
Did he?
I don't know. Well, I never had that. I don't think we had like a prototypical older brother thing where he'd like show me how to like catch worms to go fishing or whatever with, or like,
how about just check out this music?
No, it wasn't.
How much older?
3 years.
Oh, that's like,
he didn't
me
like
my
turn
brother
me
into, didn't turn you on
was to he, music.
Was he have, did he have problems or?
No, he's a great guy. He is a great guy, but, I'm trying to think if he like exposed me to, you know, he was like, I do feel like he's an older brother in the sense like other, like probably more physically capable people who have brothers mm-hmm. fight and they learn to mm-hmm. like, you know, handle yeah. themselves physically with their brother. We were not, you know, we were too like anemic to do that, but we would argue a lot, you know.
You
I think
anemic?
I we like sort of sharpened our knives on each other that way.
You mean literally anemic?
Not diagnosably, but just sort of in terms of a quality.
Not jockey.
Yeah, right. Right. Not jockey.
What did he end up doing?
He designs healthcare policy.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. What does that mean?
Well, he like works. He worked at the Department of Health and Human Services. Now he works in this program where they like develop like pilot healthcare programs that they then test on. And my sister, my younger sister, is studying to be a rabbi.
So you're Jew.
Yeah. Well, like the most secular Jew. Like our seders when I was a kid were just like.
Really?
Like minstrel shows for Judaism. It was like so offensive if anyone could see it.
Everybody just puts on the costume once a year.
Exactly. It was like just.
Well, but not conservative. So like reform or nothing.
Like whatever's lower than reform.
So no bar mitzvah?
No bar mitzvah.
Both your parents are Jewish?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I have one grandfather who was a Lutheran who played organ in a church. But other than that.
You have a grandfather who's Lutheran?
Yeah.
So someone's not a Jew.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting. But, all right, so you're in Philadelphia, growing up.
Right.
Playing trumpet.
Right. And then I got braces.
When did that start, the trumpet?
I started when I was in second grade.
Could you play?
Yeah, I was pretty good. And and then I started devouring all these jazz books. I would, like, read the autobiography of Miles Davis.
Did you read Art Pepper, Straight Life?
I think I did read Straight Life.
It's crazy, that book.
Chet Baker's book. I don't remember that much about Straight Life.
It's all about jail and heroin. It's about 350 pages about heroin.
Crazy.
Like 50 pages about sex. Like, basically, our paper's like, sex came pretty natural to me. Let's talk about Alcatraz and Narcanon and heroin. And Chet Baker was a rat. That was his big problem.
Chet Baker was like,
Yeah, he called him out.
He snitched?
Yeah.
Really?
Chet was a snitch.
I didn't know that.
I heard. That's what, according to Art.
Wow.
I believe that Chet was a snitch.
It's amazing to me that all these guys, you know, these like incredibly technically proficient musicians were heroin addicts. Like, it just seems like, how did they?
I don't know how they lived their life.
Like, if I get 6 hours of sleep, I'm basically incapacitated. You know, like, I can't. These guys are playing like the most advanced, sophisticated music.
For hours.
Like, for hours and hours and hours. And it's physical, too, you know? So
it takes a lot out of you.
Yeah.
Strung out.
Right.
I know. I just read the book on Richard Pryor and just the amount of coke and booze he was doing and going into like writers' meetings. I was like, what the fuck? Was it different then? I mean, I'd done drinking and drugs in my life, but I could not work at that level.
Is there a point at which, because I'm such a control freak, I haven't really done much drinking or drugs, not when I've worked like at all. And I wonder if there's sometimes I've started drinking more lately and it makes me, unsurprisingly, less inhibited, and it made me wonder. It's like maybe there is like a sweet spot where if you're just like a little drunk, it's helpful.
Well, that's what we're all chasing, is that sweet spot in life. Yeah, it's like the worst alcoholics are. They're just like, there's that
just
one
let
time.
Me find
I hit it once, and they spend their life trying to get back to that sweet spot.
Right.
But that's good. That never appealed to you, huh? That life.
Yeah, I think, well, it's because in my very early experiences drinking, I was like, I could feel how irritating I was being. Like, I could feel myself annoying people, but I didn't know how to stop.
But when you get uninhibited, what does that look like? I mean, I've seen you do improv, and you're pretty uninhibited in a lot of ways.
Improv's like one of the only places where I feel sort of unself-conscious. Because I've been doing it long enough,
right?
You know, that I'm not watching myself do it usually when I'm doing
it. But you're very sharp at it, and you're kind of dark-natured.
I think probably like I'm a little uncomfortable being aggressive in real life or being, you know, outwardly dark. So maybe like,
that's where it comes out. Probably. Am I right about that? Or
I don't know. It's funny. I've never seen myself do a show, so I don't really, it's interesting to hear that. I don't know. It probably depends on the night too, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also you have, I guess, sort of your physicality. You're a large, tall guy.
Sure.
And
cadaverous.
Cadaverous. So maybe I'm just projecting the other part. Maybe you just look creepy.
Right. Just look. Right. I look like I came out of a TV ward.
No,
it's okay.
No, I feel bad.
Don't feel bad. I don't feel bad.
Your sister's going to be a rabbi?
She's going to be a rabbi.
That's bizarre. What kind of rabbi? How hardcore?
Reconstructionist.
Oh,
I
yeah,
think.
Those. Yeah. Yeah. The hippie Jews.
Yeah, right.
Kind of like, we're groovy, we're young. Jews can be cool.
Yeah.
That one?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's who they are. I think my brother was into that for a while.
Really?
All right, so you're playing trumpet. You're how old were you reading about Chet Baker? 12, 13?
Yeah, I don't know when I started like devouring jazz books, but it was through middle school.
Did you listen to jazz?
I did. Yeah, I listened to a lot of jazz.
Yeah. To this day?
Yeah, although less now, because I think like some of the bebop stuff is so cerebral.
Yeah.
Like now I'm more, I'll listen to like Ella Fitzgerald or something that's kind of like...
singing, some nice.
Yeah,
that's
something
nice.
That's not like, doesn't, you know, feel like math problems.
Math problems are like, it's, you're exhausted.
Yeah, right.
Like what kind of mood is that going to... I have a cousin that can't listen to bebop because it makes her anxious.
Yeah, I totally get that. I totally get that. Also because if you feel like you're naturally sort of a cerebral person and your brain's always crowded with thoughts, it's bebop just seems like you're just doubling down on your,
sure,
you know,
it can be good background music to me. Like my brain is always sort of spinning, but like when I put that on, it is sort of soothing.
Yeah,
because I don't pay a passive interaction with it. It kind of seems like a reasonable backdrop to my head, but depending on which bebop it is, I mean, some of it can be kind of shrill and a little bit much.
Yeah,
but there's some shit that I can listen to.
It's even like, you know, like there's like comedy that's like math comedy. It's like the sharpest, most cerebral comedy, but
like
it doesn't.
Community?
Yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't, sometimes even a show like that, like I'll objectively know like this is hilarious and
right,
brilliant. But
right,
unless I'm in the right mood, it's hard for me to watch it because I find it, I don't know, I'm easily overstimulated or something.
Well, I mean, 30 Rock was like that too.
Yeah,
it's almost
right,
like movies from the 30s that the banter is so clip and so quick and everything is so orchestrated. There's no room, like you're watching something so orchestrated and controlled, it's hard to appreciate it on, hard to just laugh.
Yeah, it's like, I end up marveling.
Right, exactly,
at
like,
it.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
They really put a lot into this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that took a lot to construct that bit.
And they found the perfect specific and the perfect, it's like, and then the performances, they like hit it just right.
Right.
But it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, whereas like you know, sometimes just it's definitely not a fart joke.
Yeah, right.
So all right, so what happens to the trumpet?
Oh, I got career? Braces, and I couldn't play trumpet anymore because I had braces. Like it
was that a up. Choice that you could make or
To not get braces?
Yeah,
my parents took me to Wynton Marcellus's dentist in New York because they
a
were
jazz
like
dentist?
A jazz. His name was Dr. Chops, and they were like,
was it really his name?
Well, it wasn't his.
Oh, that was
it.
His
wasn't
nickname.
His birth name, but
right.
Yes. And because they were like, because I was so upset about it, I was like, this is going to ruin my trumpet playing. So they did everything they could, but ultimately I had to get them because my teeth were going to look like, you know, a train wreck otherwise. And
really?
I could, it apparently wasn't just cosmetic. It would have like actually been
bad for
like a medical problem.
Well, I had that, but they
really?
Took, yeah, they took the braces off. They were a failure.
Really? What does that mean? Like they were just like the teeth won?
It's my jaw issue. It's a jaw issue ultimately. My jaws don't lined up. So I had to have made, the choice was like, the braces are only going to do so much. We need to sort of realign your jaw, break it and realign it, which
they
is not.
Break it.
No, I didn't do it. So now my teeth are, my gums are all receded and my teeth
really?
Only meet in two places. But I've lived that way. I'm okay. I'm, you know, my teeth aren't falling out of my head. But
I have an indentation in my chest, like a slope.
From orthodonture?
No, it didn't get that bad. It's a slope in my chest. And there was another, they had a procedure. They're like, we can put a metal pole through the behind your sternum and then snap this like this slope out so that it's not concave anymore, but we might hit your heart. And I didn't do that either.
Oh my God. Yeah. What happens if they hit your heart?
Well, it's not great.
Never good.
It's not,
when
it's
the
not,
pole that they're running through your rib cage hits your heart.
Someone's telling me there's surgeries in Korea where they'll break women's jaws to make them look more Caucasian. Like they'll like to it's like a cosmetic surgery.
What the fuck is wrong?
It sounds really fucked up.
It's
and
harder.
Horrible.
It's harder for me to hear that stuff.
Yeah.
Like I have a physical reaction. Like there's apparently a bunch of plastic surgeons in Asia. I was about to say the Orient. Is that wrong? Is that outdated?
I don't think it's wrong if you're like a 19th century like explorer.
In the Orient, where they have plastic surgery to make people look like anime.
Really?
Like the women want to look like anime.
Oh, yeah, and they get those like, they
big
make
eyes?
Their pupils bigger.
Dude, I don't even know.
Oh, God, I should look into that.
Really? Is that something you might want
to
do?
So I can... I would look so horrifying.
So you get braces and
yeah, I couldn't play.
Were you playing a lot at that point though?
Yeah, I used to practice hours every day. I was like, really obsessive
shame.
About it.
Have you picked it back up?
A little bit. It doesn't hold up well to neglect though.
Oh really?
Yeah. It, you know, it's like a muscular instrument.
Was it heartbreaking?
Yeah, I was really bummed out about it. I used to take pliers and take the braces off, the wire out of the braces, because I get so frustrated.
So like, you could play?
Yeah.
Did it work?
It worked, but then you had to get the wire back in. You know, it's a short-term fix.
So you go into the orthodontist without the wire?
Yeah, he'd be like, what the fuck? I had this weird orthodontist. He used to...
Not Dr. I've talked Chops? About
this. No, this is the guy in my hometown. He had a life-size mural of himself on the wall, putting braces on jungle animals. And then he had a picture of himself as an orthodontist putting braces on himself dressed as Superman. He had like all this weird...
Neither one of those makes sense to me at all.
No, no.
They're both bizarre. Was he really putting braces on, or they were just a painting or a drawing?
It was a painting. He never actually went to the... He never actually put went braces on jungle
on
animals.
On safari?
But yeah.
Tranquilized lions and put braces on them?
But it was a 3D mural. Like he had like a wooden... I think there was a walrus too. I don't think it adhered to any sort of like actual... like Animal Kingdom logic. It was like all these different animals had come together like predators and prey because they all wanted to get braces from this guy.
Did he commission these paintings or do them himself?
I hope he did them himself, but I think he probably commissioned them.
And they were large.
Huge, wall size.
So it was like, so the kids will enjoy this. That was his angle, was like, there's animals, I'm putting braces on animals. This is for the children to look at when they come in.
Yeah, and there's a harrowing... like barely recognizable version of me putting these things on the putting braces on the animals. Like he looked weird in them. I wish I was in the murals.
Yeah,
I was his.
And the other one was him as Superman putting braces on himself.
Yeah,
it's bizarre.
It was really strange.
And you went to that guy for what, 2-3 years?
Yeah.
Was he odd guy?
He was pretty weird. He'd be like Dizzy Gillespie, man. He'd always like bring up Dizzy Gillespie, and I'd always be so resentful because I was like, you're the reason I can't.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't his fault.
Why do you keep rubbing it in?
Right.
So you'd walk in with your wireless braces.
Yeah.
And he'd be like, here comes the Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah, right. And then
let's get that wire back in there.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's so sad, the struggle. And your parents were just got to do it, huh?
Yeah. Well, he basically said, like, you're not going to be able to, your teeth are going to be sticking out in such a way that it'll be hard to play. Anyway
you'll be like this freak.
Right, exactly.
So, but you didn't think of other instruments or try other instruments?
No, at that point it was like...
How old were you, like 13, 14?
I guess I was probably 14 or 15. I don't
and
know.
How much of your identity was wrapped up in
all
the porn?
All of it. I think, like, in retrospect, I think it wasn't even... I like jazz music, but I think more I like the idea of being a jazz musician. Like, I was
sure,
like, that'll tell me who I am. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't need to, you know, have my own tastes or preferences or beliefs. It's just, like, all imported all from
That's what you jazz. Do. That's what we do, man. Especially as creative people. You just sort of like, you want to just backload a whole persona onto yourself.
It's so weird. I used to wear a fedora.
Did you? When you were 14?
Oh, I looked like such a moron. One time I was walking down the street and I was wearing this fedora in New York. My brother went
to
college.
And you were 14
there.
Or 15?
Yeah, but I didn't have like the other clothes I wore weren't.
A fedora like?
Yeah, it was like just normal 14-year-old boy clothes. And a guy drove up to me, stopped, rolled down his passenger side window and just went, loose the hat. And then just drove away. And I took it off and I never wore it again.
Was that it?
That was it.
That should be the name of your CD.
Yeah.
Lose the Hat.
It'll be on my tombstone.
Lose the Hat.
Lose the Hat.
Oh, and you're so fragile then.
Oh, my God. I already was like, every moment I had the hat on, I was aware, like I was thinking about the fact that I was wearing that hat. Like it was.
You had
like,
to.
Yeah.
What do you think inspired you to wear the hat? What made you decide that
You
one?
Know, I probably thought I was like
Cause
a
I
latter
wore fedoras too.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you pull them off? I feel like you'd actually, you might be able to
well,
do it.
Well, there's one up there someone gave me. But no, but like everything become. But when I was younger, like I had a large brim hat that someone had given me. There was a period there where I bought a derby because I thought that might work. Like I went to a fancy hat store and I bought a derby.
Where do you remember the first time you wore the derby out?
Yeah, I didn't. I only wore it once or twice. You know, it just didn't work out. You know, because it's so look at me-ish. That's the only problem with that is as when you start to realize that about your ego as a performer before you become a performer.
Yeah.
There's so much of what you're doing is just sort of like. And you don't really think of it at the time, but it's really to draw attention to yourself.
Oh, constantly. Halloween, I used to do all this stuff that was like looking back, now I hate Halloween. Like, I'm too self-conscious to participate in Halloween. But as a kid, that was right before I was performing. I remember one year I learned the words to Staying Alive, you know, the Saturday Night Fever. And I got like four of my friends and I choreographed a dance. And I got them to go. They were essentially like accessories in my costume. Like I bullied my friends into like being backup dancers. And then I would go door to door and we would ring the door. And then I would lip sync to staying alive. Uh-huh. And all my friends would do this choreographed dance behind me.
And but did you let them get candy as well? Or?
They got candy, but none of that. I was looking for something bigger than candy.
But yeah, yeah. But you had leadership qualities, clearly.
Well, I don't know. It was just coercive and annoying.
Why do you remember the logic behind that? Did you wear a disco outfit?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think I just thought, well, people are really gonna love this. And I remember one guy, he opened the door and he's like, "Do you want candy or not?" Shit, I ain't got all night. And I was like,
really?
Yeah, I just like wilted.
Oh my God, yeah. Another lose the hat moment.
Yeah, I've had a lot of lose the hat moments. Message received, world.
So, all right, so like, when do you start the interest in the comedic arts?
Well, my brother went to college in New York, and he'd been
Which
to
college?
ASCAT. He went to Columbia.
How old are you?
I'm 30.
Oh, you're young.
Yeah.
Okay, so he went to Columbia.
Yeah.
That's smart.
Yeah, yeah, he's a smarty pants. Yeah. And he said, he told me about ASCAT, you know, ASCAT. Oh, right,
that's
you
went to
ASCAT,
Washington,
right.
Yeah. At the old space.
Right, with that converted strip club.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that used to be a strip club.
With the weird chairs?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Yeah, like on 23rd or 2nd,
yeah.
Something like that.
Someone told me that they're like old... I guess it used to be a strip club, and they had like a fairly large Hasidic clientele. So like these Hasids would show up to the old UCP,
oh, yeah,
and they'd think they were going to see a strip show, and then they just have to watch like alt comedy. For
oh, that's right. And like
minutes.
And Matt Walsh like lived upstairs.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Right. So that era.
Right.
Yeah.
So I heard about that from him, and then I started taking the train up into the city and taking classes
from Philly.
Yeah, from outside of Philadelphia.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So. All right, so you visited your brother. You lost the hat.
Yeah, I lost the hat.
did you throw it away? Or
yeah, and that's a good question. I don't know. I probably just buried it deep in a closet.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, I don't think I've ever been more confident than I was in middle school going into high school. Like, the period that people most people describe as, like, the worst.
Yeah.
I feel like I felt bulletproof. I was, like, walking around in a hat and doing disco dances and shit. Now I'm, like, riddled with self-doubt. But back then I was, like...
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. It's an interesting idea, because is that really confidence? Because there's a picture of me performing, not in middle school, but later, yeah, wearing a big brimmed hat.
Yeah.
I'm on stage with a t-shirt and glasses that are tinted.
Are you doing stand-up or are you playing music?
Stand-up.
Okay.
Wearing a big brimmed hat.
Jesus.
Like, to me though, like, I don't, like, I know I was cocky.
Right.
But I don't think I was, there was no way I was confident. Like, it was like what you were saying is this sort of like, you know, backloading a persona into yourself. Like, you know, you see yourself in a certain way and you sort of model yourself after these other people, but you haven't really earned your personality.
When you would wear that stuff, aren't you just kind of like loading heckler's guns for them a little bit? Like
I didn't think about that. No. I thought I was some sort of like, you know, hey man, I've seen some shit. That guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you
like
know,
world was, weary, like.
Yeah, I was aggressively, you know, I was 23,
right.
You know, and I'd really been
23-year-olds with old man affectations are the fucking worst.
I was that guy.
Guys who are like veterans, who like, like grizzled old salt.
Yeah, yeah.
23-year-olds should just wander into the ocean.
Well, they're just trying to.
Yeah, you're right.
Cover
up. I'm not.
Oh no. But yeah. like I'm just addressing the fact that you felt the most confident you were because you had decided on some things, but it wasn't really confidence.
No, right. It didn't go that deep.
I have to imagine, but I don't know how anyone handles it, but you seem like a sensitive guy, kind of fragile, perhaps.
Maybe.
I don't know. Maybe that's just your character. But I mean, like, I would think that going into, well, you weren't doing acting per se, but going into improv, I would have, that must have shredded whatever sense of persona that you had decided upon.
Well, I was such a dick. The first class, you know, I was the youngest, I was 16, and it was mostly people in their 20s. And the first class, there's this great improviser who used to teach in New York called Billy Merritt.
He's out here now.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Yeah.
And he was my first teacher, and the first day in class you went around the room and he said, tell everybody your name and why you're here. And I said, when it got to me, I was like, or he said, your name and what brought you here. And I, and when it got to me, I said, my name's Zach, and what brought me here was a train. I mean, what a fucking moron. And he was like unbelievably gracious about it. And he was like, no, why do you want to do this?
You're going for the laugh.
Yeah, but Jesus.
Did you get it?
No, thank of course, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, I think I got like a
everybody was
courtesy
ready to share.
Laugh. Right. Yeah, but, and then I was like, you know, I'm actually 30 years old, but I have a disease that causes me to look younger. And then people laughed at that because, again, just to try to like ease the tension that I created with my unfunny remark. Yeah. And then I was like, why are you laughing? I'm serious. And then I was like, nah, just playing, y'all. And it was just like,
yeah.
I still feel so grateful to Billy that he had every justification to just be like, fuck this guy. Like,
but that's the dark sensibility I was talking about. You know, that your first words out of your mouth
were lying about a disease that people actually have in the world. Like,
yeah.
Oh, God. That was so, I still feel like the cringes when I think about it.
But you were cocky. You were a cocky teenager. And going for the laugh.
Yeah.
Why not? So Billy was just sort of like, okay. And did he make you get honest in that moment or didn't you?
Yeah, but he was so gentle. Like, I feel like later when I was teaching, if somebody had done that, I probably would not have been as compassionate as he was.
What would you have done?
I don't know. I think I would have like maybe, you know, made a little speech about how, you know, it wasn't necessary. You didn't have to do a frantic tap dance for approval all the time. You could just.
Right.
You know, that it makes other people uncomfortable. And it, yeah.
So you really are a product of UCB.
Yeah. And that's why I do it now. It's like, it's my favorite thing. It's where I feel like when a show's going well, like when it's a good improv show, it's the most sort of alive and myself that I feel. Do you feel that way with stand-up?
Yeah, because I improvise a lot.
Yeah.
And I love doing it to the point where I'm like, when it's going really well, I'm like, I should probably do the material, right? Like, I feel like...
Oh, that's funny. Like, it's like homework.
Well, no, but I don't know if they feel like they're getting ripped off. You know, like, even though they're getting laughs... There's something about improv in the context of stand-up where you're sort of like, do you have jokes? Do you have things you prepared? Or are we just going to... This is fun, but where's the... you know what I mean? It's one thing to go to an improv show. It's another
interesting
thing to like... Because I do have like an hour and a half of new material.
Yeah.
But if I get on a riff and things are kind of popping and I'm exploring, I love it. It's the best thing in the world for me. But for the first time the other night, I realized like I'd done probably about 25 minutes of that. And it was great.
Yeah.
But then I start going like, okay, let's start the show.
But hold on. Now, the audience is reacting positively, right?
Sure.
They're laughing. They're interested.
Yes.
Do they care? As long as it's...
No,
right?
I'm projecting.
They have projecting. No... They might not even know what's...
Well, one guy said... Some guy tweeted like, I saw Marin the other night. He improvised for a half an hour. And then he did about a half an hour of his hour. So now I guess I got to go to another show to see the rest of his hour. Which is, but he's being funny, and he wasn't unhappy about it. But for me to improvise it, for things to happen and to ride that out, I love it. But I never did improv really. I always did it by myself with an audience.
I think I would be too. I kind of feel like there's something about improv where you like, I guess it's shared responsibility and shared blame if it goes bad that makes it. The idea of doing it by myself is just like totally. Although I did take a stand-up comedy class. Like when I was 16, I took an improv class and a stand-up comedy class.
At UCB?
No, it was called like the American Comedy Institute, which is just
who
like,
taught that?
Stephen Rosenfeld or something.
Steve Rosenfeld from San Francisco?
Maybe.
Huh.
Yeah. But that I was like, I felt, you know, really ill at ease. And then when there's other people, I can't imagine. Do you, I'm curious about that. Can I ask you a question? With Twitter, right? I'm not on Twitter. And you strike me as probably as a sensitive gentleman as well.
Oh, yeah.
How do you withstand, like inevitably you see things, even that, right? That guy makes a joke.
Yeah.
It's like a playful joke.
Yeah.
But like, I feel like when I first started doing The Office... I read comments. I would read comments, and I could recite like mean comments that I read 5 years ago. And I had to just be like, I'm not reading anything ever again.
Cause
it just like, yeah, hurt my feelings. Like,
yeah.
and it, it, right.
Yeah,
like, but isn't Twitter just like an endless stream of even positive, negative feedback? Doesn't it just like crowd your brain?
Yes, it does, to the point where I think it's making me like slightly detached from life.
Really?
Yeah. Like it's emotional roller coaster. It's like a crack pipe. You know, it's like it's going good for a while and then like you just get a bad hit and some guy takes you down. But the sensation. It's hard to understand, man. But I used to take it really personally, and I'd just flame out at trolls and like lose my mind. But now I'm actually developing a bit of a tougher skin.
Really?
I've always wanted to, you know, just to sort of like take a hit. Because a lot of times the negative things people say will hit home with you if you have felt them about yourself.
Right.
If they're off base, you're like, wrong guy.
Right.
But usually if it's within the spectrum of things that you judge yourself harshly about, which with sensitive people can be pretty broad.
Right.
Then it's going to hurt. So lately I've just started to realize that those people are just mean, horrible people, and I don't even know who would go out of their way to do that.
Do nice things make you feel good, or is it just the bad things make you feel bad?
Nice things make me feel good, but I don't take them in as much or in the same way.
Right, they're less credible in some way, right? Like you
well,
just
yeah, because
feel like,
you're insecure in some way, or you're self-hating. And also, the problem is nice things, like if they're really genuine, like you helped me out, or like, you know, I was going through a hard time and that stuff, I can hear that stuff. But if people like, you know, I got a good laugh, I'm like, that's not enough, really, or whatever.
Yeah.
But the fact is, if someone hits a good insult on you, like you feel it in your guts. Like it's so visceral. It's horrible.
It's like a physical. Yeah.
It is. But it's like it is a feeling and it is profound.
So that's enough just to
no,
have
it's
an
not
intense
good.
Feeling.
It's not good.
Right. That's what I mean.
No, it is hard, dude, and I wouldn't recommend it necessarily if you don't find any joy in engaging with the world on that level. I kind of like it. I like the poetry of it.
Yeah.
I like just because I get very impulsive about Twitter, and sometimes I throw stuff out there. It's just garbage. Like I'll just put the word nap, and just tweet it.
Right.
Because that's what I'm gonna do.
Does it become kind of like a diary where you can look back at old tweets and chart your moods and your periods of your life? You're like, oh, that was.
I don't do it as much as I used to.
Yeah.
Like I've been a little busy, and also you burn a lot of material that way. But you find you're very sensitive to that.
Yeah, I mean,
everybody is. Every performer I know is. Anyone who goes to a comment section, there's nothing good at the comments.
I saw an interview with someone, it was like Molly Shannon or someone was saying that they described it as cutting, you know, like when like
it is,
adolescents
that's
cut.
That's right.
They're like reading comments is like cutting.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So I try to avoid it.
So, okay. So you're 16, you're taking Billy Merritt's class. It's funny because as somebody who is a UCB product, a product of it, I don't want to say that you're a product, though you are a piece of entertainment product at this point. But like, because all they were all sort of Del Close guys, people, right? That they come from that Chicago school, and then they built this other thing. It's just interesting that now there are definitely graduates of the UCB style of improv.
Yeah, it's pretty strange how like UCB has kind of populated a generation of TV.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I know, it's pretty peculiar
because Second City had done it before,
right?
And now, like, they kind of are the new thing. Those four people. I remember when they were just those four people.
It's interesting. Like, when people go to Harvard or something and then they become, a titan of industry, it kind of makes sense because it's like, well, this is an institution that's designed with success in mind.
Right.
But UCB, like I said, it's like an old strip club. There's, like, all these used condoms like behind the seats.
There are,
you know, yeah, they like always find these like old condoms because I guess it was also people would have sex for money there. And
but how long did that go on for? I think
it was like an endless horrific Easter egg kind of prophylactics. That place felt so loose, like it didn't feel like, okay, these are a bunch of people who are really focused on their own ascent.
I don't know if they were necessarily.
No, I don't think they were. So that's what's so strange is that then produced all these people who...
Well, that was 2001 you started going? Yeah. So they were all sort of around, or no?
Yeah, Amy had just started on SNL, I think.
Okay,
recently.
So Matt and Ian and Matt were all there.
Yeah.
The two Matts, Ian and Amy.
Right.
Were teaching.
Yeah, I never took classes with any of them. I did like workshops and stuff, but they were around. You could see them perform.
So
I used to fall asleep. Matt Besser did a one-man show called May I Help You, Dumbass, where he had a phone number that was similar to like a computer helpline. And so people would call him and he'd fuck with them. And he made a CD. They call him thinking he was the computer helpline and then he'd fuck with them. And I used to fall asleep to that in high school. I would like listen to Besser's one man show as I fell asleep.
Really?
Yeah, it's weird.
So you were locked in. So you went right from the trumpet. Now you had a new thing.
Yeah.
So the first improv class you took, was with Billy.
Right.
And what happened? Like, what made you go like, oh, fuck, this is great?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, part of it is I liked having a secret comedy life in New York. Like, I didn't tell anyone I went to high school with that I was doing it. Like, it was exciting for me to get to go to New York and hang out with all these 20-year-olds and, like, be in New York. And yeah. And no
one knew. Your parents were cool with it?
They were really cool with it. Yeah, it was weird. And it was just the most fun. It was, like, the scariest, funnest, most exciting thing. And I felt like I felt like I was okay at it. I felt like, I'm okay at this. Maybe.
Did it feel like, did you get, like, at what, with the trumpet, were you able to improvise?
Yeah. Yeah. I used to, that's the other thing. I think, like, when I wanted to be a jazz musician, my fantasy of what my life would be like playing in basement clubs late at night, improvising, making not a lot of money, but right. like really artistically engaged. And then doing improv is not that big a leap. You know, you're in these basement clubs improvising late at night, not making any money.
Right.
It's like very similar. If you couldn't play trumpet anymore, but you wanted as close an existence to a jazz musician as you could.
Were you actually involved in a very deep personal exploration that is collaborative?
Yeah, exactly.
Huh.
It's not lonely.
No. But like, it is you. Like, you know, you have this support and you know that there is a structure there.
Right.
But you can go wherever you want to go.
That's right. Right. It needs you, but you're not all there is.
Right.
And that was really nice. I also think I'm such
And also you have freedom.
You have so much freedom.
Creative freedom.
The other thing is I think I'm such a anxious, like kind of controlling guy. That there was something so wonderful about something, a task, right? Improvising, where if you aren't present,
yeah.
if you don't sort of relinquish control, you'll be humiliated. You cannot. It is an absolute necessity that you be present and give up your sort of preconceived notions and your, you know. So that to me was like the one time I could get out of my obsessive compulsive brain and just be present.
Do you have real OCD?
I had some of that stuff. Like, yeah, when I was did you ever read The Witches by Roald Dahl?
Uh-uh.
It's a kid's book, but uh-huh. it's about these witches. But at the beginning of the book, he says, anyone could be a witch. They don't wear a tall, pointy hat. They don't ride on broomsticks. The post lady could be a witch. The old lady down the street could be a witch. Even your teacher who's reading you this book right now could be a witch. See how she smiles at the absurdity of the idea? That could be a cover. She could be a witch. So I read that when I was a kid. Someone read it to me. And I got into my head, I was like, what if my mom's a witch? And I'd ask her, I'd be like, Mom, are you a witch? And she'd be like, no, I'm not a witch. And I'd be like, okay. But that's what a witch would say.
Right.
And I would just endlessly torture myself where I was like, oh, fuck, like, what if my mom's a witch?
Yeah.
And I feel like I've had some version of that ever since, you know, like it obviously I eventually realized that my mom was not in fact a witch, but you that what, kind of what, like what unanswerable
what did it take to prove that to you?
I just think it was just
went
time.
Away over time.
Yeah.
there wasn't an inquisition at the house.
No, I never caught her in a coven and then I, you know, it disappeared.
So what that is called, that that's what is that called, some type of thinking? It's
like looping thoughts.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what the official diagnosis is,
right? Oh, so you've had that
kind I've of had thing. Lots of stuff like that.
It's
yeah,
it's frustrating.
Yeah,
and it's because it defies logic. Like, your brain wants to repeat it.
It's unresolvable, right?
That's
yeah. terrifying. Like, from a little kid's perspective, like, what's the scariest thing? To not be able to trust or rely on the people have to trust and rely on. And so it's like, okay, so what if I couldn't trust her? And there's no way, you can't solve it. You can just endlessly run on that
wheel.
Right,
but the thought of them not being trustable or them being a witch, certainly your parents, is just, it's that same feeling of like getting insulted. It's just like, it hurts your heart every time. Like, what if my mom, like,
right. It's exciting.
Terrifying.
It's kind of titillating in some weird way.
Yeah. Like, and terrifying.
Terrifying. Right. It's like, it gives you a charge, a horrible charge.
Right.
But it makes you feel like, oh,
horrible charge.
Yeah.
That's what you get. That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's that feeling of like, when you see that bad tweet, a horrible charge.
It's compelling. It's really compelling.
That's what I'm telling you.
Yeah, right. And it wasn't, my mom was wonderful. It wasn't like she was, she didn't
right.
have witch-like attributes
yeah, but that's
in
what,
any way.
But that's what a woman with a secret life of a witch would be
exactly.
like.
Exactly, right.
I don't know. I'd revisit.
You think I should take another look?
So you're going in there. But what do you think that is, though? The control thing is like, Because everybody has it to a certain degree, but you've called yourself sort of a control freak, several times in this. How does that manifest itself? I mean, is it generally, because usually it's some sort of almost innate attempt at dealing with anxiety and fear.
Yeah, I think it was anxious.
Yeah.
I think like my family is like a very talky family.
You know?
It's like
a psychologist kid.
Right. And to some extent, like the degree to which you could articulate your feelings or your opinions was the degree to which you had, a voice, which makes sense.
Right.
But I think I ended up being sort of cerebral, and my default way of managing things was to try to sort of think them through or
to figure them out, narrate them.
You know.
Did you ever need medicine?
No, or maybe, but I never took medicine. Yeah.
So you dealt with it.
Yeah.
The improv helped.
Yeah, it really helped. And everyone has their things, you know.
Sure.
Everyone has their whatever, their compulsions or their...
So when did you start to surface as a sort of a star within the ranks over there? I mean, you were 16. No, but I mean, just in terms of like, how often were you going? And like, what happened? So you graduated high school and you just what?
Well, I started performing there when I was still in high school. So I would take the train. I wasn't sleeping a lot because I would do these shows in New York 2 or 3 times a week. And then I'd come home and then go
to
high
school.
At
1 in the morning?
Yeah. I'd like be driving home from Hamilton, New Jersey train station. And I'd turn on in the winter. I'd turn on the AC, roll down the windows, blast music and just like scream to try to keep myself awake as I drove home because I was so tired.
Wow.
So that was kind of exhausting. But then I went to college in New York. I went to NYU, mostly just because I wanted to keep doing UCB stuff.
Yeah.
And then that just continued for years, you know.
So you finished college?
Yeah, I finished college.
What did you do at college?
Well, I went to this program called Gallatin at NYU, which is like this like choose your own adventure college. Like it's you don't
did they actually call it that, choose your own adventure?
I don't know if that's in their literature, but that's the gist of it. It's like it's all your you don't have a major, you have a colloquium, and there are all these hybrid things. So it's like it's always the a major at Gallatin would be like the intersection of micro gastronomy and third wave feminism. It's like these like hyper specific combined things. So like my colloquium ended up being the relationship between Christianity and the civil rights and abolitionist movements. But it was kind of bullshit. I think a lot of people get a good education there, but I was just focused on UCB.
But why would you pick those two? Like if you were just focused on UCB, like if you had everything in the world, like it seemed like micro gastronomy, is that when feminism?
Well, it's just like all these like, you know,
various. But why'd you pick the Christianity and the civil rights movement?
I think because I read all these jazz books when I was a kid, I was sort of interested in Black history.
Yeah.
So I just signed up for all these classes that I was interested in, and a lot of them were Black history classes. And then when it came time to sort of title my major, I just was like, well, I took a lot of stuff about Black history and a lot of religions courses, so I just sort of retroactively came up with that.
What was the religion curiosity about?
I don't know. I guess I probably took less religion courses than Black history courses.
Did you get a good grade in this thing? Do they have grades?
Yeah, I did okay. But I also did, like, I would get internship credit for, I was teaching at UCB in college, so I would get, like, internship credit for teaching.
Uh-huh.
I would try to get class credit for all this shit I did at UCB, and they would do it, because they were, like, an incredibly accommodating, flexible.
But what kind of degree do you get after that?
Bachelor of Arts.
And was that, this was a special program within NYU that you had to find? You sought it out? You just didn't want to go to regular college?
I said right before I went to college, I had a conversation with my parents because my parents paid for college. And NYU is really expensive.
Yeah, right.
I said, you know, I think I just want to go to UCB and I think I want to pursue this. And maybe we should, you know, I could go to a like CUNY City College and it'd be $5,000 and I'd still have a degree. And they were like, no, you should go to NYU. In retrospect, I think it would have been a good idea to go to the City College. Like, it's so expensive. College is so expensive that unless you really...
So you didn't find that it did nothing for you.
No, the teachers were amazing. You know, there's like smart people working there. And I met people who I, you know, still very close with, a couple. But I don't think it was worth six figures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did it give you a deeper understanding of the Black community?
Yeah.
Like, you know, in a pinch, Could you be some sort of community leader?
Or, that's just what the black community needs is me leading the charge. I think of myself as the new Al Sharpton.
Now, good for you.
Thank you.
So that's you could always do that.
I think I did have like a really fucked up, inappropriate sense of like my. Like when I was a kid, we were on a family vacation once, and Louis Armstrong came on the CD player.
Yeah,
and in Miles Davis's autobiography, he called Louis Armstrong an Uncle Tom, which Louis Armstrong was not an Uncle Tom. He was like a pioneer, you know.
Right.
But I just read Miles Davis' autobiography, and I was just parroting everything I'd heard Miles Davis said. So I said in the car, I was like, you know, Louis Armstrong was an Uncle Tom. And my father and my brother were like, what the fuck? You can't say that. Like, A, it's not true. B, like, have you looked in a mirror? Like, who are you? Like, who do you think you are? And I was insistent. I was so angry.
How old are you? This was 14.
Yeah, I was like 15, probably 14. What? And I just like went to the fucking mats like about how Louis Armstrong had set the black community back, which is the most idiotic thing you could say.
You went with Miles.
Yeah.
You're on board. Consider yourself lucky to have a father and a brother that were sophisticated enough to fight you on it.
Oh, God. They were like, you moron.
Like, didn't even really know what you were saying. Necessarily.
That might have actually gotten physical. I think I might have actually struck my brother in defense of Miles Davis' unfair assessment of Louis Armstrong. That might have been one of our few fights where this has to come to blows.
Did he knock your fedora off?
Yeah, right.
Well, that's interesting, man.
Yeah, it's
so
weird.
So you ended up teaching improv where? At UCB?
At UCB,
That's it? And then you just moved out here or what?
Well, no. I remember who Katie Dippold is? She wrote The Heat, and she works with Paul Feig a lot, and she wrote on Parks and Rec. We used to take improv classes together, mm-hmm. but we were talking about once, you know, years and years and years ago, she was like, what do you want to do? And I remember saying, like, if I could just do improv and have a temp job during the day, I think I'd be happy.
That was your big plan?
Yeah, I never thought like, oh, I'm going to be an actor.
Yeah.
But then I started doing commercials to help pay
the
bills.
Well, that's interesting because you saw improv as a way of life and as a therapeutic way of life in a way, and it's something vital that, you know, it wasn't something like, why ruin it by having it be a job?
Yeah, and it was just the happiest I ever felt. It was like the most.
And you were teaching.
Yeah. And so, and then I started doing commercials because I was like, I need to, you know, some more money.
Yeah.
And then that led to getting this agent. And then I got a movie called In the Loop. And then I was from that.
I remember that. Was that with
James Gandolfini?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's a military satire of some kind, right?
Or... Yeah, it's about sort of the build up to the war in Iraq.
Right.
So I did that movie. And I remember thinking when I shot that movie, I was like, wouldn't it be amazing if Allison Jones, because I knew who Allison Jones, the mm-hmm. casting director of all these great comedies, I was like, what if she saw that and she liked me and she put me on something? And then that happened.
Really?
It was so weird.
How did you know her?
I didn't know her. She saw the movie and then...
What if Allison Jones saw the
movie? Oh, I knew her because I was obsessed with Freaks and Geeks, so I'd found out who cast it. And the American Office, I was like, I would watch that. And so I just knew who she was.
You were obsessed with Freaks and Geeks?
I loved Freaks and Geeks. Martin Starr, to me, was like... The working with Martin Starr now is such a weird, surreal thing, because Martin Starr was like one of my favorite comedic actors.
Really?
Come on, Bill Havlicek?
No, I love it. Like, I love talking to him about it. And there's moments in that character's... arc that just kill me,
right?
More than comedy. You must have identified with them.
It's just heartbreaking.
How old were you? Were you young enough when was that on? How did you first experience?
I saw it on
DVD.
Like, a friend of mine was like, you have to watch this.
When you were in high school or older?
No, older, in college.
So you got obsessed with Freaks and Geeks in college?
Yeah, totally.
The point where you found out who the casting director was.
yeah and then I saw she cast all these other great things.
Okay, so she sees In the Loop.
She saw it. And I had that fantasy. I was like, what if I do this movie? She sees it. And then she set up a meeting with me and the producers of The Office. And then they gave me a part on The Office. And this is like, I'd had that exact fantasy. I was like, what if she saw it? And then I got on The Office somehow. And it happened.
How many offices did you do?
Like 50 or something. I did a bunch. Yeah. I mean, it was a very small part. You know, I was like a tertiary character in the sixth season. So, But it's so weird. You know, they say that thing like life is what happens when you're busy making other plans or whatever. But I feel like in this weird way, like these plans actually panned out.
Right.
And so it's...
Has she used you in other things?
Yeah, I've done some movies, like very small parts in movies with Paul Feig. And
which ones? Well, I can't.
I did a tiny thing in The Heat, and I just did a small thing in this movie, Spy, that he made.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's a nice guy.
He's wonderful.
He acted on my show, and I've talked to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah, it's interesting when people are that high achieving and like warm people. It's,
yeah.
They're not.
Yeah, they're around. Yeah.
Yeah. It's reassuring when you meet someone like that.
And then how did you get the gig in Silicon Valley?
I just auditioned. I auditioned for Mike Judge, and he put me in it. And it's all sort of bewildering. I mean, I feel so lucky. I feel so
crazy. It's a great part. I mean, it's great for you. I mean, how much of it is your conception in terms of the character? Because you're sort of doing you're not being yourself.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
There is...
hopefully not.
A very defined, you know, sensibility to that character.
It's
how close was it to your audition?
Different. Initially, the part was this kind of more conventional business guy.
Uh-huh.
And then in the second episode, which was written by this guy, Carson Mell, who's this really great writer, he wrote stuff that sort of pointed to him being a little bit more... I don't know if low status is the right word, but a little bit more of a gentle kind of peculiar character. And then I started improvising a lot. I would improvise a lot. And they keep some of it, but mostly I think they started to realize, like, okay, this is what he likes. This is what he's interested in. And then they would write to that, and then I'd improvise based on what they'd wrote. And so I suppose in some ways it was probably
collaborative. So you helped chisel it out.
I think so. But also, like, you know, they're the best. The writing on that show is pretty staggering, so I don't want to like take credit. The character is their idea, but I think my improvising probably helped them learn my voice.
Right, because you know all those elements of control freakiness.
Yeah, I guess.
Right, so. You know, like in almost a codependent, you know,
it's interesting
nurturing thing that is hyper anxious in a way.
Yeah, that's funny,
right?
Yeah. Well, I also think because I'm not like a trained actor, I need to improvise just to get loose. Like I have to improvise in scenes just so that I can be present, you know.
But I like also the idea that, you know, finding that character through what was written and also whatever the interaction is with these other characters, because like Martin Starr as a Satanist is completely like he's thrilled about it. And he, you know, he's had his journey to where he is now is kind of daunting in terms of how show business has sort of shook him up and to the point where he was, you know, he abandoned it a bit. So I imagine that, you know, having to find your character the way it is the most organic way to do it. I mean,
well, you know what else too? I played this character on The Office was kind of like a bit of a creepy guy, like a little off-putting. And I really wanted to make sure that I wanted to play someone who I really like loved, like I thought was like essentially a sweet person, you know.
Right.
Even if they're peculiar, I wanted them to. Yeah, I wanted.
So you're aware of that.
Yeah, I was like, I don't want to play. I don't want to just play like dark. You know, like you said, I've played most of the parts I got early on were these kind of dark, off-putting guys.
Right. Right.
And I was like, I want to play. I don't mind if he's strange, but I just want him to have like his heart in the right place.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And you like working with everybody? Obviously, you're going to say you're going to be.
Everyone always says yes, right? But this is the happiest professional experience I maybe have ever had. It's so, so good.
Why?
Because I just adore all of those guys.
Yeah.
I just think they're like, I've never had like a big group of male friends before.
Yeah.
And this is like the first time I've had that experience. Uh-huh. Of like, I just really like them. Uh-huh. I just find them like easy to be around. I can be myself. One thing that's really nice about that show is like, I don't know, you'll go on sets, right? And sometimes you'll get the feeling that there's like seething resentment and all sorts of unexpressed anger.
Yeah.
What's nice is like in the instances where people have a problem on that show, like if anyone ever gets mad at each other,
yeah,
we'll like fight, we'll like talk about it.
Oh really? Like about what?
Well, I don't know, like if someone said made a joke that hurt someone else's feelings or kind of, that kind of shit, someone will be like, that hurt my feelings. Like people like actually just talk about stuff.
No
and then
kidding.
It gets resolved. It's like the healthiest working environment just among the cast. It's so wonderful. And so there feels like there's like real affection and respect. And then the writers and the you know, I trust those guys so much and they're so collaborative. And the other thing is in the edits, like I trust their editing so much. Like you can take big swings because you know they're not going to let you look like a prick in the edit.
Right.
Like
Right, big swings in terms of improvising.
Yeah, you can try stuff, you can do weird things, and they'll protect the character.
How much do you improvise?
A fair amount.
They let you do that? I mean, yeah. In terms of, like, there is a script.
Oh, yeah, the script is mostly what you see on the show.
Right.
But sometimes they'll use improvised stuff, and right. Like I said, it helps me just loosen
they do
up.
Do they do, like, a few takes, and they say, like, have more fun with, you know, just go for it?
You know, it's the most, they're really... open it's like Mike Judge, Alec Berg, who's a writer, was like ran Seinfeld for a while. Uh-huh. Like all these people are incredibly experienced. Like if I had written for as long and as well as these guys have, yeah. I might be kind of proprietary about the material.
Yeah,
but they're really not. I mean, they just, it's not even like, okay, do our script five times and then do one fun run. They're like, let you improvise throughout. I think they want us to get the scripted stuff because usually that's the best version of the scene, you know.
Right.
But it's amazing how egoless the whole place feels.
And what was your experience when you were first cast with Martin Starr, who you had these feelings about?
It's weird, you know. It's weird to have like the sort of fantasy version of a person replaced by the real version of the person. It's hard for me now to think of him as like the guy who played Bill Havlicek because I've had enough, you know, just like personal experiences with him that I...
But like when he first got there, did you...
I was intimidated, you know? I was intimidated and excited and...
Did you say anything?
Yeah, I probably did. I probably gushed. I'm usually not very good about playing it cool. It's hard for me to...
He's a very sweet guy.
He's a very sweet guy. He's such a like sensitive, kind guy. He took me out to lunch right after we started,
uh-huh.
like after we shot the pilot.
Yeah.
And that was nice like that. It felt like...
Just you two?
Yeah, just the two of us.
Uh-huh.
And he's Buddhist. He was telling me about Buddhism. And
yeah, it seems to work for him. He was brought up with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Most people who are Buddhist became Buddhist. I feel like most people I know who are Buddhist became Buddhist within the past like 5 weeks. You know,
right,
I mean?
Right.
It's like always like a recent affectation. Yeah, yeah. But Martin's like the real deal.
Yeah, he was brought up with that strand of it.
Yeah.
And so it's very interesting. I must have watched the first episode because the fella who died.
Yeah.
What's his name again?
Christopher Evan Welsh.
Christopher Evan Welsh died. And they sort of recast that part with a woman who seems to be kind of playing him a little.
Yeah, it's similarly dysfunctional character, yeah.
That must have been heavy to have that kind of tragedy on a set.
Yeah, it was weird. It happened in the midst of shooting. And, you know, this I didn't know him very well because we hadn't shot a lot of stuff together.
But still, it was like, you know.
It's like heartbreaking.
Yeah.
He was a young guy, had a young daughter, and he was... I think kind of like the funniest guy on the show. I mean, he was
an amazing character.
Incredible. And in TV, you know, usually you see people sort of warm up into their characters.
Yeah.
He just came in like first episode with this fully fleshed out, like very ornate, peculiar guy.
Yeah.
I was blown away by it. And I have like this acting coach in New York who was asking about the show. And I told her that he was doing it. And she's like, him? Because she'd seen him in Shakespeare in the Park. He'd done all this like heavy New York theater stuff where he'd been amazing. So
he's a real
He's like
actor.
The real deal, yeah.
Real, and the whole thing is pretty fascinating. I really took to it right away.
That's nice to hear, Mark.
Because like it didn't, the comedy ensemble is so great.
Right.
And the backdrop is so great that it doesn't matter really what's, you know, the idea of the startup or what's real and what isn't real. It doesn't matter because the comedy's so fucking strong and the world is so strong for comedy and it's just great. And you got Judge over there.
Right.
Everybody. It's going to go on for a while.
I hope so.
All right, man. It was good talking
to you.
Yeah,
you too.
Thanks for coming, Zach.
Thank you.
That's it. Good talk, right? Great guy. Love that guy. Very funny. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. We'll get it updated with the new tour dates as soon as the tickets go on sale. You heard it here first. Is that why am I saying that? Okay. Yeah, you can do other stuff at WTF Pod. Get on the mailing list. I'm going to write the update right now to send out tomorrow, which will be Monday, which is not your business. It'll just screw up your whole time thing. But you know, I'm doing this on the road. And all right. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.